15 questions with the prestigious Cleveland Clinic Internal Medicine Program Director.
I would like to start by asking you, as a program director for the Internal Medicine Residency Program, what do you look for in an internal medicine applicant?
That's a great question, and one that we get. And I'm sorry that I can't just go, or I'm not going through my recruiting spiel, because I think it's so important to let applicants know, you know, what are the things that we're looking for. And it's actually more simple than you may think, or that others may admit. So we're looking obviously for some degree of accomplishment, but it isn't like Nobel Prize winning accomplishment. It comes in many different ways. So the accomplishment that we're looking for is really, I think, simple in the fact that we want to be able to project whether someone will take good care of patients. So we're looking for evidence of that potential, but also evidence of establishing, you know, some of the benchmarks that we want to see people do. When we think about medical students and transitioning into residency, we think about what they're able to do and what they're able to potentially do with additional training. And, you know, one of those things is we all lump patient care into, you know, patient care, but actually it's reporting on patients. It's being able to navigate patients through a healthcare setting, whether that's note writing or whether that's writing orders. So, you know, obviously we look for people that have excellent patient care skills as demonstrated by what rotations they've done, where they've done them. And we look for surrogates for that sort of proof, I guess, in their letters of recommendation. So I guess, you know, Cleveland Clinic, we're a patient first organization. We really value evidence and, you know, future potential in taking excellent care of patients in patient care. The other thing that we look for, I think, is alignment of values. I don't know if people talk about that enough, but it's so important to understand, you know, as your professional identity forms as a medical student and through residency, that you're in the right milieu. If you find yourself in a program that doesn't align with your own personal values or future professional values, it can be very difficult to be successful. So we look for that. We look for evidence of values, and some of the surrogates we use for that are evidence of leadership, evidence of, you know, past medical education or past education, like people that used to be teachers, people that were maybe leaders in their community, wherever they're from. And we look for, you know, evidence of real community engagement, not just the things you do for like, you know, one day, or, you know, Habitat for Humanity is great, but if you do that for just one day, does that really make a meaningful impact in your community? So we look for, you know, that alignment of values, because we're in it in our medical center, in our program, for the long haul. And we like to see an alignment of values, because we think people do better in that situation. And then there's another element too, I think we really look for, and I think it may come in different forms, but scholarly potential or scholarly achievement, those are very different things. So I guess we look for people that are curious, to sort of simplify it, either curious about, you know, academic medical research questions, or curious about other forms of, you know, scholarship, or curious about the world based on past careers or what they've sort of done. So those are three big pillars that I think of that we look for. And hopefully, you know, if I were to show you like our rubric, how we look at, you know, students' records, it's very holistic. It's not just one thing. It's like a whole bunch of things, and it all sorts of adds up over time. And I think if you met anybody in our program, you would see that we have a great diversity of backgrounds and a great diversity of experiences because of that holistic process that we currently have.
That is a very, you know, comprehensive answer to a very complex question. A lot of students think that step scores, and we'll go over these details in a second, step scores, if I don't get a score, I'm not mad, but it's way more complex than that. And I love the way you divide it into multiple areas, and some people might be, you know, advanced in research, they're not that much into academic, leadership skills, but others have that versus others. So, and the idea of having a diverse group of residents is, you know, now the topic of every medical journal, every medical education, that we need to increase diversity in our healthcare system. So that brings me to my second question, which is, do you consider IMGs in your program? And a lot of my, you know, followers and the people watching this video are international graduates. Do you consider IMGs at the Cleveland Clinic IM program?
So I will say absolutely. And that's not just, lip service either. So I telling a little bit about my background, you know, where I trained, this was not something that we saw in my training at University of North Carolina. And that's not a detriment to that institution. It's a great training program, but that wasn't something that was part of my experience. But I'll be honest, in my first job at the Carilion Clinic, where there's now the Virginia Tech Carilion School of Medicine, my eyes were open to a couple of different realities that I hadn't been exposed to yet. And one of them was the great work and the great contributions that those from other countries that went to medical school in other countries, not just from the residents, but also the faculty. I mean, we had some of the chairs and some of the other leaders in the medical center, you just come to find out that they didn't train in all the places that maybe you'd heard of. And so for me as a newer, medical educator, that was, is humbling, because you realize the world is bigger than maybe you thought it was. And maybe some of the paradigms that you had sort of engendered or thought about, like, maybe just weren't even true. And the same, quite honestly, was true around osteopathic residents. We filled our entire class of, I think it was 19 or 20 first year residents with osteopathic and mostly international medical grads. And so I became enamored with that because I saw how good these doctors were, and I worked with them, and I saw them go on to learn about scholarship and learn about research. And that was part of my job, was to teach them that, but also see them being successful in finding jobs and moving on with their families. And so it was great. So, when I went back then to University of North Carolina to be a program director for my first program director is the MedPeds program, I went back to like where I trained, and it was not like that, right? And so I felt, maybe a little bit of pressure to, think a little bit differently about things. But it was only when I was looking for the job and when I was interviewed for the job at the Cleveland Clinic, that was actually an attractant for me, was the heterogeneity of the class and the heterogeneity of the residency program. And quite frankly, the heterogeneity of the backgrounds of the leaders. Dr. Venu Menon, who's the program director for the cardiology program, was one of my staff members at UNC when I was a resident, and he was part of the group that interviewed me for the job. And he, when we talked about it, he was very upfront. He said, this is a fantastic opportunity to get some of the best residents from all over the world. Why wouldn't you do that if you could? And I said, I agree with you. We're definitely going to keep doing that. So, you look at the traditions and the footprint of the sort of your employer too. Cleveland Clinic's all over the world. It's not just in Cleveland. And the richness of the of my own education as a mid-career physician has only been more so because of the interactions I've had from the nature of the leadership at Cleveland Clinic too. So it goes both ways, I think, from the people you train, but it also comes from the people above. And I've always just loved that about my job currently and about the place I work. So yes, that's a really long-winded way of saying, yes, we are very we will always be looking at those from other countries. I think we have a good system for doing so. And I think we've had really good success too. Those that come from our program, whether they've been in the US for a year or two, or they literally come from another country to start intern year, they've done really well. And I'm just so humbled by the amount of transitions they have to go through oftentimes and what they have to overcome that I don't think I could have done that when I was in training. I moved from Ohio to North Carolina, and I acted like it was the hardest thing ever. And I literally had one of the first year residents who didn't even have an apartment when he came to orientation, and he had to get a car, get an apartment. And here I am like working with him on the wards. He's writing notes and he's doing great work. And I could have never done that. So I feel like in a lot of ways I've grown through some of these things too. And certainly the work that IMGs do in our program is absolutely, we couldn't do it without their input.
Thank you so much for you and the leadership of the Cleveland Clinic for considering IMGs and having a good number of IMGs at your program. And as you said, we learn from each other. Everyone should have a fair game. That's what I always say in my channel, is that not all IMGs are great, but also not all US applicants are great. Not all osteopathic applicants are great. Some are great. There is a spectrum in each, you know, group of applicants. You cannot say that I'm not considering any IMGs or I'm not considering any US applicant. Every applicant, in my opinion, deserves a fair, you know, shot. Their application should be evaluated in a holistic way. And at that point, if you don't think they're fit for the program, that's fair. But just applying a filter of no IMGs, I don't think that's fair. And that brings me to my next question, which is, how is the selection process different between international graduates and US seniors? I'm sure US seniors do away rotations. They are more knowledgeable about the system. They have letters of recommendation, maybe from people inside the Cleveland Clinic, inside big US institutions. How do you feel the process of selecting applicants from these two groups is different?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and I don't want to give the impression that I'm at McDonald's giving away the prize recipes for the special sauce or anything, but we don't have two processes because we really do have just one process. But the big decision points for most residencies, and I think for most candidates, is the interview, right? So we have a slightly different rubric for those from outside of the US, because we know that we can't necessarily compare apples to oranges, and add other fruit in that particular category, because everybody with different backgrounds, I mean, medical schools are accredited differently, and there's different standards, and the dean's letter looks different, and the letters of recommendation, that the standards. So there's a couple of things that we look at. We look at historical precedent of whether we've had somebody from that school. That probably means a lot. There's definitely a factor where we do look at whether someone's had U.S. Experience, clinical experience, and they, you know, if they get a letter. But that's not to say that we don't have people that we do have people that match with us that don't have U.S. experience or don't have, you know, letters from the Cleveland Clinic, for instance. So I actually think in a lot of ways, it's maybe even a little bit easier to recruit from the pool of international medical graduates because the affinity is so high for our program, and people are, you know, really going out of their way to demonstrate that alignment and their interest. And that's not to say that other groups are not as aligned or have that affinity. But we sort of know what we're looking for, and people know how to show us that, and then they come and they do well. So we do have the same process, though. So once an interview is given, everybody is on the same footing. I'll just be completely frank about that. I mean, if you come in from school X and you get, you know, really do well on our interviews, we place a lot of emphasis on the interview and how you do on the interview day. There's a little bit of emphasis on, you know, your CV and letters of recommendation in the final analysis, but it's more so about how you do in the interview and how that goes. So, we take some things into account, but we don't do a lot of moving. We don't do any moving of, you know, once the rank list is sort of made, we don't do special favors. We don't, you know, move people up and down. So I feel like we have a fair, as transparent as we can, and I think it's equitable. We try to make it as equitable as possible. So I don't know if that answers your question, but
that definitely answered the question. To hear that this process is very fair and doesn't discriminate between, you know, different types of applicants. Now a lot of applicants, now we're in the end of August, beginning of September, ERAS is due in 4 weeks. All applicants are working on their personal statement, ERAS application. What do you look for when you're reviewing these personal statement, ERAS application? What are red flags you might exclude someone from the interview based on these, and what things might impress you for an applicant?
Yeah, I think that's a really fair and transparent question. So we use filters only for those things that would make someone not be a candidate to match with us, right? So what would make you not a candidate to match with us? Well, I guess the first thing would be is if you couldn't get a license. So if we don't have passing scores of the USMLE, we would be a little bit worried. Like if someone doesn't have a passing step two score, for instance, it would not be a good idea to interview them because we're not sure that they'll pass and they wouldn't be able to get a license, right? So you have to have, you know, two passing scores because you have to be able to get a state license. The other thing, you know, obvious red flags would be like and this doesn't apply very often, but you know, like criminal offenses, felonies like that, you know. Outside of that, I think the big thing that we look for is no gap of more than 5 years between graduation from medical school. But even with that, we've offered interviews for that. If people have been in practice in another country, or if they did a fellowship or something like that, we'll look at that. So that's not an absolute, but that's one of the things. And then obviously, if your application is incomplete, those are ways. And so you want to make sure you release your scores. You want to make sure all your letters are there. We do, you know, I should know this. I think we have a 3-letter requirement. We don't necessarily always look at the quote unquote chair letter the same as we do like a personal letter. So I think having personal letters of recommendation are probably favored, and having, you know, 3 of those. Red flags, I think, anything that, I mean, now I think anything that looks like it could have been written by AI will be a red flag. If there's a discrepancy in, you know, what you write in your personal statement, like what's on your CV, I mean, that obviously will get things. And then if there's incomplete, you know, if there's a time gap that isn't explained, I mean, those are some of the red flags. And then we also have these things sort of like pink flags, you know, beware, you know, there's sometimes in the dean's letters or letters of recommendation, if they're not good letter writers, you know, they'll have this like vague, you know, statements about that don't really say anything, and maybe kind of skirt around the issue about someone's performance, you know, like they showed up every day, or they generally were open to feedback. I mean, that's not a good thing. So that sort of falls into the pink flag, but students don't have any control over that. The things that they have control over is who they ask to write their letters. And I always recommend that they ask someone to write them a strong letter and say, can you write me a strong letter of recommendation? And if somebody offers to write a letter, that's usually a good sign. But the personal statement should really just be a reflection of their own values, and you know, it doesn't have to be a recapitulation of their CV. That's not a red flag, but you know, we want to hear about you. I mean, we want to hear the kinds of like, what was your road to medicine? Not just hardship road, but like, what kind of things do you have to overcome? What biases have you faced, or how have you grown as a person? You know, that's becoming increasingly hard to tell people apart, and sometimes there's that little inkling of perseverance or resilience or some sort of grit that can be in a personal statement that really can set someone apart. And I know that there's maybe a little bit of difficulty in explaining that, because culturally some people don't want to talk about the things they've had to go through, wherever they're from, or some of the things they've overcome. And so we're not making a spectacle of those things, but I definitely would encourage people to tell their story as they understand it. Because that's who we really want to know. And that's the part I find as a program director right now, just to be it. I mean, it's amazing the experiences some of the residents in our program have had. And I just can't believe I get a chance to work with them. I have a lot of gratitude for that. So those are the kinds of things we want to hear about.
Exactly. And I have sometimes applicants have amazing stories of, you know, challenges, hardships that they overcame until they came here. And they don't highlight that. They talk about patient presentation for like 2 paragraphs, 55-year-old diabetes. Like, no, we want to talk about you and that patient. And I want to talk about your experiences. What got you in the specialty? Why you want to come here? So it's an art. And I made multiple videos to help people with that. So if you want to learn about personal statement, go ahead and check these videos out.
I mean, that's a great point. So one of the first year residents who I just worked with, he was like an Olympic caliber sprinter. I don't know if it was in his application. It just came out in conversation one day. And I was like, how did we get you in our program? I mean, it was like, you know, it's just cool the things you learn. And I just encourage people to be themselves.
Awesome. Awesome. Now moving to our fifth question, which is the STEP scores. All IMGs ask me about STEP scores every day. In their opinion, the STEP scores are the defining factor of you getting an interview or not. If you have that score, you're in. If you don't have that score, you're out. What is your take on that?
That in our system, that is not the reality. And I'm not contradicting anyone's opinion, because obviously we look at Well, we're not looking at step one scores at all. So, I mean, unless someone has failed a step exam, it will not affect you positively or negatively in our process, regardless of country of origin. And then we do look at the step two score because it's there to look at. And we don't, once you pass, we don't, take away points on our rubric, but we sometimes add a point or two if somebody had like in the 95th percentile or something like that. So on the grand scheme of things, that's like 2-3% of the overall potential score. So it really doesn't make or break. I mean, you would get just as many points or more, with having really strong letters of recommendation, for instance, and combine that with a good personal statement that has some sort of statement about, your life or what you've overcome or some compelling, journey that you've been on in medicine. So we don't take it away completely, but it's been much, much overrated and overused in the past. Although we still want people to get credit for, doing really well on it, but we just don't overemphasize that. So that I would not say that that's a major criterion for selection for an interview. And it has almost nothing to do with ranking if you interview with us.
That's very glad to hear. I, always encourage people to study well, perform well on the exams. And I think, as you said, they should get credit for that, but it should not be the factor. You should not be, being interviewed or ranked just based on score. So it's glad to hear that.
Just to let you know, we really try to have a non-biased interview process. So all of our interviewers go through anti-bias training. And we actually blind the interviewers to the grades and the board scores. So the person that's on the other side of the Zoom when you're interviewing with us doesn't know your board scores or your grades.
Oh, wow. That's impressive. So that definitely gives an unbiased opinion, because no matter what, if you know the score, you might have bias to ask certain type of questions that would favor, higher score applicants.
Yeah, that's what the research would show too. We also blind, if you got into AOA or some of these other awards, you can say that to your interviewer, but it's not like you're getting this big, plate of all these awards and things like that. So if it's in your personal statement or if it's in there, people will still find out, but we just really want people to get to know them as an applicant without this pre-existing sort of bias.
Awesome. Sixth question is about research. We talked about, one of the pillars being academic potential and research. What do you look for when you're assessing research? Is it publication, experience?
Yeah, so that's a really good and I think a really relevant question in this day and age, because we are looking to mark ourselves apart from others because there's no step one score. But it is something that we look for, evidence and potential for scholarship. Our program does prize a patient-first approach. The Cleveland Clinic does. However, we are also well known for, translational research, clinical research, and innovation. Our residency program, for what it's worth, is ranked number 9 in the country in research output for residents in our medicine program. So our residents are very productive. And we have a good system in place for those that want to do research in subspecialties and or general medicine, for instance, and we have a clinical school. We have a lot of things that promote research. But you don't have to come in, with a lab or, grants or, even publications. There's plenty of people that match in our program that are relatively research naive, having never done bench or clinical research. But it's really about the potential and their interest in it that we gauge. But I will say that, again, everything in its due course, everything has a season. If someone comes in and has an advanced degree, for instance, we take that into consideration positively. If they've had a first author publication, we take that into consideration positively. But again, it's also measured against the other things that I talked about. So, coming in with an MD PhD, for instance, with 3 first author publications, that'll get you a certain amount of points, but it won't keep climbing. And we don't want to double count that against some of the other clinical things. So it's emphasized and it's prized, but we definitely have people that haven't had a lot of research experience that also come to our program.
Awesome. We touched base briefly about the U.S. clinical experience. I want to ask a question about the types of U.S. clinical experience. As you know, most IMGs come to the U.S. after they graduate. They're not eligible for the electives or sub-Is that fourth year senior students do. What do you think the value of these externship or observerships that people do to get experience in the US and US LORs?
I think it's highly variable on the medical center where you're doing the observership. And I think it has a lot to do with who's sponsoring you too. I've participated on the, like the faculty end of observerships. And I mean, I think you can actually tell a lot about a person. I mean, we have this issue. I mean, there are former international medical grads who are working in research at Cleveland Clinic. Some of them have shadowed, observed with me. And I feel like they're a member of the team. I mean, they can have clinical reasoning discussions with you. They can certainly have interpersonal communication. I'm thinking about the competencies. They can demonstrate competency-based achievement in a lot of ways just by being a member of the team. So I think they're of value, but I think it is specific to where you're doing it, who you're doing it with. And that isn't meant to sound, like it's some sort of fraternity. You have to work with these people to be good. But I don't look at it skeptically. I just want to know more. I want to know more about what you were actually doing, how long you were doing it. And I think longitudinal is better. A week somewhere is probably not as good as a month. And if you do something with someone, 1 week a month or 1 week every week for a year, for instance, that means a lot more, because then a person can get a really long view of you. So there's a student, or not a student, a former, she's a doctor who's worked with me several times longitudinally. And I told her, I hope she's applying to a residency, because I think she's going to be great. And I could see her working with our residents, because I've seen her working alongside of our residents as an observer. So I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, definitely. I can see, I agree with you regarding where you're doing it. You have to do it with people that we kind of trust, recognize, and work long enough with someone so they can say something about you. Or just like these generic, this person is hardworking, and as you said, shows up to work. And, they have to have these personal connections with you and evaluate you on a long, multiple day basis, so they can say something legit about you and genuine about you.
And I do worry about, I don't know if this exists or not, I've always wondered about predatory observerships where it costs a lot of money and you're not sure. I know that there's an exchange probably insinuated, you'll get a letter if you do this, but I would instruct students to be careful and go to places where students have had success in the past, or former students have had success in the past. But I think you hit it right on the head when you said, it's probably better to be a clinical rotator at a place, as long as you can, also, you can rotate as a visiting student, obviously, and be an AI even in our setting and have real patient care. But those are harder to obtain when you're still in school. But even that can be of limited value if it doesn't have the longitudinal nature, or if you're actually performing as a acting intern, for instance, like the other students on site. So I think that there's pluses and minuses to observerships. I tend to see glass half full more so than not, based on my personal experience with those that I've done it with. But with that caveat.
And thank you for pointing out regarding like some, rotations offering LORs for money. And I feel that sometimes even the students are looking for these type of stuff, so they don't want to put the effort to get the LOR. A lot of students have the expectation, I'm like just showing up, I'm just going to follow that physician for like a month and get an LOR. And that's not the case. You have to study, prepare for the patient. That's how you can impress someone. I love the idea that you mentioned, that sometimes even without, doing an actual sub-I, just observership, you can tell about the student. My friend matched at Baylor, which is like a very good program. By doing an observership there, he was able to impress the people by his knowledge, his demeanor, the way he shows up, not just like following people around. So I feel it's both on the students and some companies that just offer people, rotations to come and get an LOR. And I think you need to earn it. The LOR, you need to work for it. You don't just get it. Awesome. So we touched base about the gap idea and year of graduation. My eighth question is regarding the gap. How do you define the gap? If somebody, for example, trained in India, they did residency in India, worked for 2-3 years and now applying to residency, is that considered a gap? Or by gap, you mean somebody who's not doing anything?
Yeah, so I think we're more concerned about a gap where there's no patient care, or you know, research is fine, but we would prefer to know about clinical activity within the last 5 years. If it's like, what is that? And there's actually and they're in our, there's members of our program that trained in India and they did internship, or we even had somebody that did foundations training in the UK, you know, and that, you know, even though they graduated from medical school, they were still in a training program. So, and we don't categorically say no way. In fact, we look at people all the time that are beyond the gap that otherwise have a pretty exemplary career. And it's just about what were they doing in between.
Awesome. My ninth question is, how does the selection process work at the Cleveland Clinic? We talked about so many factors, but do you, you know, evaluate all applicants? Do you divide? How does this process work? Like, as an
so, this is a really good question, and I'm happy to share with you. It's a very long hours intensive process. We get about 6,000 to 6,500 applications.
Wow.
We try to sort those the best we can electronically into those that we think are real candidates, and everybody's a real candidate, but like good candidates with no failures, you know, don't have a five-year gap, or we understand sort of what their status is. And then we look at a large proportion of those manually. We divide up into teams. I'm very involved. Our chief residents are very involved. Our faculty leaders, our associate program directors, we have 9. And we also have 17 core faculty, and we have others that volunteer to help. So with that mob of people descends upon this extremely large bolus of applications, and we score every one that we can. And then, you know, sometimes if we don't, we sometimes get, you know, a little gift from above, and somebody will say, hey, will you look at my application? And whether it's a student or a faculty member, or somebody that worked with somebody. And so we do rely a little bit on people to remind us about people that are in there that we maybe didn't find, whether they rotated with us or if it's somebody that, you know, is local or something like that. So with that system, we feel much better suited to not miss anybody who's really good. And that's really what we're looking for. We're trying to be as equitable, fair, inclusive as we can. So it takes a lot of time. I wish there was a way to put it into AI and just say, these are the 600 people you should interview, but we interview about 600 to 650 people. And so it's a pretty big cut to go from 6,000 to 600, but that's all we have capacity for, because that's a lot of faculty time to do those interviews. Our actual selection process then on the interview day is everybody gets 2 interviews. We have some behaviorally based questions and some standard, you know, interview questions, but it's really a time to explore the space with the interviewer and the applicant. And then we also have some downtime during our day 2 where you're just, you know, go get a drink of water, go to the bathroom, and we have a meet and greet with the chiefs. And there's, you know, other interactions the night before, sort of a happy hour kind of thing. And it's good. And we have open lines of communication after the interview. If you have questions, you can reach out to us. We don't do any hijinks. I mean, we abide by the code of conduct. We don't send confusing post-interview communications. We don't, you know, we don't block people's emails from sending us thank you notes, but we don't respond to them usually. We follow the rules, but we're also, you know, I trained in the South. I'm very Southern and hospitality wise. And so if you have a question for me, I'm happy to answer it. And if we can put you in contact with someone on the residency, we'll do that. Cause we found that's the way to treat people is through, you know, being polite and hospitable. So let's say you interviewed with us and you had a question about cardiology or cardiology research, I could put you in contact with one of the residents, for instance, and or one of the faculty, and that dialogue would go on in the background, and I would have no idea what's going on. It doesn't affect your rank. It doesn't affect your matchability. It's really for you to make a selection. So, you know, I look at this as a job interview, and it's a job interview for us and for you. So you're interviewing us too. And I say this to all applicants, is like, we want you to want to come here. And so we're going to give you all the information that you feel like you need to move across the country or across the world, to, to train with us for 3 years.
That is really impressive. So if I understood correctly, almost all application gets read by some, you know, part of the team and evaluated, and a decision is made to interview or not.
Yeah, I don't know that I would say almost all, but as many as we can, upwards of several thousand. So yeah, it's a lot.
That's
and we read it all. I mean, we read the dean's letter, the letters of recommendation, the personal statement.
Awesome. So this is another question we touched base on, but we can like summarize it very quickly. What mistakes do you find applicants do usually in their application, or things that advise to avoid doing these mistakes?
I think putting stuff in your application that maybe you don't know as much about as you think, to try and make it look good. That almost always never works, because invariably somebody will ask you a question about your research or your hobbies and interests are being taken out now, I know. But that was always one of the things that I would go for, is the hobbies and interests. And if you, like, for instance, if you say that you enjoy mountaineering and you've climbed all the 8,000 meter peaks in the United States or in the world, I'll say, tell me more about that. And if you don't know anything about, you know, mountaineering, then that's a problem, right? So not, you know, overstating things on your CV is a definite, you don't want to do that. And then I think over-reliance on some of the things that we talked about, that we put weight in, but not so much weight that it defines a person. So research is a classic one. People will start talking about research is their go-to thing. And we want to hear more about, like I said, you and your patient care journey, because ultimately we're training general internists who may do research, or general internists that go into subspecialty. And I think, so overemphasizing the subspecialty goals you have, or overemphasizing the research goals, at least in our program, it's not a mistake. It's just that's not as useful as some of the other approaches people can have. And I think any applicant who's just generally curious will be viewed well. If that comes through in their application, then that's great.
Awesome. So for one of those with the highest score, I assume they get the interview. How many people interview each applicant? Is it the majority of the, you know, faculty? Is it a certain number?
Oh, that's a good question. So because we have to have about 1,300 to 1,400 individual interview sessions, we rely heavily on our core faculty and APDs. I interview about 90 to 100 people personally, and our core faculty may interview like 30 to 40 each, and then our APDs may do the same number or maybe a few more. And then we also rely on other leaders. I mean, our chairs will interview, department chairs. We've had institute chairs interview. We've had general practitioner, you know, like primary care physicians in our preceptorship group that precept the residents. We even have people come that don't work with residents that just want to get to know the residency and engage. We have subspecialists, hospitalists, you name it. As long as they're an internist, they have to be an internist. But I think last year, for the 1,400 unique interviews we did, or unique interview experiences, I think about half came from Department of Hospital Medicine. Probably a quarter came from, you know, general medicine. And then about a quarter came from all the rest of the subspecialties combined, which is pretty good. It's pretty good diversity.
Oh, so some GI physicians or some kind
of... Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Cardiology, all the specialties are really represented. And if you look at our leadership map, our leadership composite, if you look at our leadership composite, I've worked really hard to have a diverse leadership group too. We have a great mix of generalists, hospitalists, subspecialists, those that are IMGs actually, and also DOs. I mean, I think we have it covered as far as like who's applying to our residency, who's in our residency, and who leads our residency.
Perfect. You emphasize the value of interviews. What qualities do you look for when interviewing applicants?
Authenticity is the thing that I look for. You know, that comes through if the themes and some of the things that are written match how you're acting or how a person portrays themselves, which is hard. But I just think just be truthful and being authentic. I try to, I personally look for a positive interaction. And so, you know, having questions about the program, I think are always a good thing. And I think just being flexible too. I mean, we do ask some behaviorally rooted questions, and there's no right or wrong answer a lot of ways, and you don't have to be right. And I think just being honest. So I like authenticity because ultimately, I mean, it's very highly likely that if you interview with us and you match with us, you're going to be working with us too. And that's the time to be authentic. So it would help if those matched up.
But you always tell me we look for someone we can talk to in the operating room. We'll be spending hours with you more than your family. So we'd rather have fun with you.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, we do have a very lighthearted approach, but it's not like a party atmosphere or anything, but we do have a very upbeat, lighthearted approach in our interview day, for instance. It's very fun.
Awesome. When it comes to ranking, we also touch base quickly on that. How much is the interview versus the application?
I would say it's probably 2/3 interview, 1/3 application.
And is it scored? Is the interview have like a score? And you, is it like a
system? Yeah, we do actually. We're very detail oriented when it comes to the scoring. We have we have anchored scoring system so that interviewer one and interviewer two will use the same anchors around the ratings. I mean, we even have a system in place that looks for outliers or if there's a discrepancy, we look forward before the rank meeting actually to adjudicate those discrepancies so that we understand what's really happening. You know, it's possible that you can have two different views of the same person and that are completely valid. Right. And so you have divergent scores based on something that happened in one interview versus not. And that's all valid information. But we also are sensitive to the fact that some people have different standards. And so we really try to keep it as fair and equitable as possible. And that's why we use the sort of anchored scoring system. It's anchored to actual behaviors and things like that.
Awesome. I'm bringing it to my final question, which is, what do you think are the strengths of the Cleveland Clinic Internal Medicine Program and why applicants listening to this video should consider this as their number one rank?
That's a great lead-in. I think the people, there's so many things that I think make our residency notable. When I was interviewing for this job, I was pretty sold that it was probably a good job. I came in person after having a screening interview. And I started meeting the faculty and I started meeting those on the search committee. It was great. I mean, you know, there's like this thing on the wall that says, you know, patients first. It's a beautiful facility too. But really, it's the people. It was my meeting with the residents who were on the selection committee that I was like, this is the place for me. I mean, 10 minutes in there, I felt like this was the place. And that was a great, you know, microcosm of what our residency is. And so I would say our biggest strength is our community, is the kindness of the community, the inclusiveness of the community of our residents. And that's the residency program for sure, but that's also GME. You know, the graduate medical education enterprise really defines a lot of what happens in a program. And our DIO, Dr. Jeremy Lippman, and our Education Institute Chair, Jamie Stoller, and all the other program directors have an incredible culture and community here at Cleveland Clinic. And our residency program is a proud member of that. We're the biggest program in the place, but it allows our residents to have the autonomy to have a community and to, have the emotional intelligence to be good citizens with each other too. We have a very positive, sustainable workflow, the work hours that we do. We don't have 24-hour call. I mean, there's so many things, but I think it starts with the residents in that community. And also it doesn't hurt. I mean, I would be negligent in not talking about the clinical environment. It's one of the best hospitals in the world. All of our departments in medicine are ranked in the top 10 in the United States. Cardiology is number one, probably in the world. I mean, it's a good place to practice too. And that's usually makes for a good clinical learning environment. So, but forced to say, I would say it's the residents that make it the best program in the country. That's just my opinion. That's what is it.
Thank you so much, Dr. Wardrop, for this amazing, insightful discussion about the residency process, the selection, and the program. Do you have any final thoughts for people listening to this video applying for Match 2024? And
yeah, I just want to say thank you for having me, but also to everyone that's out there, that's considering going into medicine or considering, you know, big M medicine, like all of medicine, surgery, pediatrics, everything, and also internal medicine. I just want to say thank you for joining the world's greatest profession. I truly believe that. And for all that's written about burnout and, you know, the medical system and everything, it's still the greatest profession to me. My daughter just started medical school, and so we get a chance to keep the family business alive. But I just want to say thank you for your interest, and don't be dismayed by this process. You will make it through the match. Hopefully you'll end up where you want to be. But if you're not, you know, that is not the end of the world. And there's always help around the corner within the community where you find yourself. So I just want to offer encouragement, but also gratitude. Thanks for having me.
So that brings us to the end of this video. Thank you so much, Dr. Wardrop, for your time and this extremely insightful interview. For our viewers, if you are a match applicant and you need help with your personal statement, CV editing, or interview preparation, make sure to check out the Match Guy services that will help you every step of the process so you can ace your residency match. Also, if you're applying this cycle, don't miss the detailed tutorial I did on how to fill your ERAS application, and you can check that out by clicking on the link here. And I will leave the link for all our resources related to the match in the description below. Good luck on your match.